Then her blood stood still with ecstasy and was stanched. But in the hall, while she was being healed, there was unpleasant and disquieting bustle. All the servants there ran about distraught, light-footed indeed, but panting in confused chorus. Petipray, the master, had veiled his face. His mother was touching the bowed and covered head with her outspread hands, desperately groping for him with her blind, upturned gaze. But Huia, Aeney saw him get up and threaten her with his gold thigh-bone, from which all the cake had been munched. He scolded her soundlessly, and his sorry little beard wagged up and down. The gods knew what abuse he was shaping with his toothless mouth and busy tongue. Perhaps its tenor was the same as what the servants were saying as they panted, for loud whispers formed themselves out of the panting and came to her ears. To the fire, to the flood, to the dogs, to the crocodile. They said it over and over. She had that awful whispering chant still in her ear when she emerged from her dream, cold with horror, then hot with ecstasy of her healing, and aware that life's rod had been laid about her shoulders. Husband and wife. Now that her eyes were open, Moot resolved to behave like a reasonable human being, and take a step worthy to stand before reason's throne. Its clear and unequivocal intent was to put Joseph out of her sight. She would lay the case for his departure before Petipray, her husband, with all the powers she had at command. She spent the next day after her dream alone, withdrawn from her sister wives and receiving no visits. She had sat beside the basin in the court and watched the darting fish. Concentrating, as we say of a person whose gaze passes over the objects in its path and fixes itself on space. But all at once, in the midst of this staring, her eyes widened in alarm, opened wider and wider as though with horror while still staring at nothing. She opened her mouth and drew in a gasping breath. Then the eyes retracted. The corners of her mouth deepened, and the lips relaxed in an unconscious smile beneath the dreaming gaze. For a whole minute, she knew not that she smiled. With a start, she pressed her hand upon those errant lips, the thumb on one cheek, the four fingers on the other. "Ye gods!" she murmured. Then it began anew, the dreamy stare, the gasp, the unconscious smiling, and the shocked recall. Until at last the conclusion came, she must make an end to it all. Toward sunset, she inquired and learned that Petipray was in the house, and summoned her maids to dress her that she might visit him. Petipray was in his western hall, which looked out on the orchard and the little summer house on the mound. The sunset light, falling through the gay outer columns, began to fill the room and enrich the pale colors on the walls, the floor, and the ceiling, where pictures flung with careless ease by an artist hand adorned the stucco facing. A swamp with hovering birds, calves jumping, ponds with ducks, a herd of bulls being driven across a ford while a crocodile leered at them out of the water. The rear wall, between the doors which led into the dining room, displayed pictures of the master of the house in his habit as he lived, and showed him returning home, attended by assiduous servants. The doors were framed in glazed tiles, covered with picture writing in blue, red, and green, on a dun-colored background. Sayings from ancient authors, and lines from hymns to the gods. Along the wall between the doors ran a sort of raised ledge with a back, both of clay, covered with white stucco and with colored picture writing on the front. This ledge, or bench, served as a stand for works of art, the presence in which Petipray's house abounded. But you could also sit on it. And there now he sat, the man full of honors, in the middle on a cushion, his feet together on a footstool, while on both sides of him extended in a row the most lovely objects, animals, images of the gods, royal sphinxes, all made of gold, malachite, and ivory. And behind him, the falcons, owls, ducks, wavy lines, and other symbols of the inscriptions. He had made himself comfortable by taking off all his clothes down to the knee-length skirt of strong white linen, with a wide starched drawstring. His upper garment, and his staff, with his sandals tied to it, lay on a lion-footed chair near one of the doors. Yet there was no relaxation in his posture. He sat up perfectly straight, his little hands stretched out in his lap. They looked tiny compared with the massiveness of his body, as did his finely shaped, severely erect head, with its aristocratically hooked nose and well-cut mouth. He sat there, a well-composed, seated statue of a fat yet dignified man. His powerful legs were like straight columns, his arms like those of a fat woman. His fat, upholstered chest was thrust out. His mild, long-lashed brown eyes looked straight before him through the hall into the red evening light. In all his fatness, he had no belly, being narrow round his hips. His navel was striking, very large and horizontal, so that it looked like a mouth. He had sat there a long time, thus motionless, in an idleness ennobled by the man's natural dignity. In the tomb which awaited him, a life-sized counterfeit would stand in a false door in darkness, in the same immovable calm which he now displayed in life, and gaze out of brown glass eyes at paintings on the wall, where his household surroundings were depicted, for purposes of magic, that he might have them with him to all eternity. This statue would be the same precisely as he was. He anticipated the identity with it as he sat here now, and made himself eternal. At his back and on the ledge close to his feet, the picture writings, red, blue, and green, expressed their meaning. On either side of him extended Pharaoh's gifts in long rows. Most consonant with the Egyptian sense of form were the painted columns between which he gazed into the evening glow. To be surrounded by possessions favors immobility. One's possessions shall endure, and oneself endure in their midst, one's limbs composed to quiet. For others, movement. For those who face the world, who sow, who give out, and giving expend themselves in their seed. But not for one constituted and made like Petipre, in the inviolability of his being. Composed, symmetrical, he sat there, without access to the world, inaccessible to the death of begetting. Eternal, a god in his chapel. A black shadow glided between the pillars, sidewise to the direction of his eyes, an outline against the red glow. It entered crouching, and so remained, silent, its brow between its hands upon the floor. He slowly turned his eyeballs toward it. It was one of Mut's naked Moorish handmaids, animal-like. He blinked and roused himself. Then he raised one hand, from the wrist only, and commanded, "Speak!" She jerked her forehead up from the floor, rolled her eyes, and answered in a husky, barbaric voice, "The mistress is at hand, and would approach the master." He bethought himself again. Then he replied, "It is granted." The little animal disappeared backwards over the threshold. Petipre sat with lifted brows. After a few moments, Mut appeared on the spot where the slave had crouched. With her elbows at her sides, she extended toward him both palms, like an offerant. He saw that she was heavily clad, in a long, full, pleated mantle above her narrow, ankle-length undergarment. Her shadowy cheeks were framed in a dark blue headcloth, like a wig, which fell on shoulders and neck, and was confined by an embroidered band. On top of it stood a cone of ointment, with a hole through which the stem of a lotus was drawn, curving down parallel with the line of the head, so that the blossoms swayed above her brow. The stones in her necklace and armbands glittered darkly. Petipre lifted his small hands likewise in greeting, and carried the back of one of them to his mouth to kiss. "Flower of the lands," he said in a tone of surprise, "lovely of face, having a place in the house of Amun, pure-handed loveliness, alone among those that bear the sistrum, and with voice of beauty when she sings." He continued on a note of joyous surprise as he rapidly repeated the stilted phrases. "You that fill the house with beauty, charming one, to whom all pay homage, familiar of the queen, you can read my heart, since you fulfill its every wish ere it be spoken, and fulfill them all by your coming." "Here is a cushion," he went on in an ordinary tone, as he drew one from behind his back and placed it on the lower ledge at his feet. "Would the gods," he resumed the courtly key, "you had come with a plea, that the greater it were, with the more joy could I grant it." He had ground for curiosity, for her visit was quite out of the usual order and tactful routine, and therefore disturbed him. He divined some special reason for it, and felt a certain uneasy joy. But for the moment, she uttered only fulsome phrases. "What wish, as your sister, could I still cherish, my master and friend?" she said in her soft voice, a sonorous alto which betrayed cultivation. "For I have breath only through you. Yet, thanks to your greatness, all is vouchsafed me. That I have a place in the temple is due to your eminence among the great of the land. That I am called friend to the queen is solely because you are Pharaoh's friend, and gilded with the favor of the sun since your rising. Without you, I were dark. As yours, I have a fullness of light." "It were useless to gainsay you, if such is your belief," he said with a smile. "At least let us take care that your fullness of light be not darkened where we stand." He clapped his hands. "Make light," he ordered the slave who appeared from the dining room. Annie demurred. "Not yet, my husband," said she. "It is hardly dusk. You were sitting to enjoy the beautiful twilight hour. I have no wish to regret that I disturbed you." "Nay, I insist," he answered her. "Receive it as evidence of that for which they blame me, that my will is like black granite from the quarries of the Retenu. I cannot change it. I am too old to alter. For to do that would be to show myself ungrateful to my dearest and best, who has guessed the secretest wish of my heart with this wish. And shall I receive her in darkness and gloom? Is it not a feast day when you come? And shall I leave the feast unillumined?" "All four lights," he said to the two servants bearing torches, with which they hastened to light the candelabra standing on columns in the four corners of the hall. "Let them burn up bright." "As you will," said she, with an admiring, submissive shrug. "Truly I know the firmness of your resolution, and may the blame rest on those who strike against it. Women cannot but esteem inflexibility in a man. Shall I say why?" "I would gladly hear." "Because only that can give worth to surrender, and make of it something of which we may be proud when we receive it." "Most charming," said he, and blinked, partly because of the brightness, for the hall now lay in the light of 20 lamp-wicks stuck in blazing wax, that sent up thick glaring flames till the hall became a sea of mingled milk and blood from the white light and the sunset glow. But partly, too, he blinked reflectively at the meaning her words might bear. Obviously she had a request, he thought, and no small one, otherwise she would not so carefully lead up to it. "It is not her way, for she knows full well my honorable peculiarities, and how much it means to me to be left in peace, and take nothing upon myself. And she is usually too proud to ask anything. Her pride and my convenience thus coincide. Yet it would be good, and elevate my spirits, to do her a favor and show my power. I am curious and concerned to hear what she would have. The best would be if it seemed to her great, yet was not so for me, so that I may do her pleasure without too great cost to my comfort. Lo, there is a conflict in my breast. It rises from my justified self-esteem that flows from my peculiar and consecrated state, and makes me find it hateful when I am approached too closely and my rest disturbed, and on the other hand, from my desire to show myself loving and strong to this woman. She is lovely in her heavy robe, which she wears in my presence for the same reason that made me command the lights to be brought. Lovely, with her eyes like precious stones, and her shadowy cheeks. I love her, in so far as my justified self-esteem permits. But here is the actual contradiction, for I hate her, too. I always hate her, because of the claim which, of course, she does not make upon me, but which is taken for granted in a marriage. Yet I do not like to hate her, Rather, I would that I could love her without hate. Were she to give me good occasion to show myself strong and loving, the hatred might be taken from my love, and I might be happy. Therefore am I so curious to know what she would have, if also a little disturbed on account of my conduct. Such were Petitpré's thoughts as he blinked, while the slaves finished lighting the lamps, and with silent haste withdrew, the torches held in their crossed arms. "You permit me to sit beside you?" he heard Annie ask with a little laugh. Starting from his thoughts, he bent once more to arrange the cushion as he expressed his pleasure. She sat down at his feet on the inscribed ledge. "Truly," she said, "it happens too seldom that we are together like this for an hour, enjoying each other's presence without other purpose than to talk, of no matter what. For with an object in view, we must talk, whereas, without one, talk is the pleasanter for being superfluous. Do you not agree?" He nodded assent, sitting with his big, feminine-looking arms stretched out along the backrest of the ledge. He thought, "Seldom happens? It never happens, for we members of this noble and exalted family, parents and children, lead our lives apart, each in his own place. We avoid each other out of delicacy, save when we break bread. That it happens today must have a reason, and I am full of curiosity and misgiving. Am I wrong? Is she here simply to see me, to be with me at this hour, because her nature demands it? I do not know what to wish, for I could wish that she should have a need, provided it be not too inconvenient to me. Yet that she came for the sake of my presence solely, I could wish even more. Almost,